The following is from Eden's Tree of Death, found on supremejustice.net. Chapter 29. Do Right and Risk the Consequences. Does a believer's Christian responsibility differ depending upon where his national citizenship resides? The answer is no, because he is bound to a morality that does not change each time he crosses national borders. Opportunities to fulfill Christian responsibilities may change, but not the responsibilities themselves. Unfortunately, a conspiracy of silence among many Christians concerning biblical civil government and God's criminal justice system has allowed modern nations to operate without the censure of absolute morality. Sadly, most church members have been separated from biblical foundations for so long that they don't know where to biblically begin to hope for a positive change in civil government. Revival and renewal start in the heart and in hearing God's word applied to everyday life. It is true that Jesus' earthly ministry was not bent on overthrowing the Roman government, but that did not stop him or his followers from speaking out against criminal acts or teaching biblical truth on the matter, even if it could cost them their head. Their activism stands in stark contrast to modern-day pastors and religious politicians. In the Shakespearean play King Lear, a character remarks, "'Tis the time's plague when madmen lead the blind." We are truly living in a time of spiritual blindness, where a plague of madmen in pulpits leads our nation into perdition. Because they follow their own pleasure, most people today will avoid a political issue if standing up for righteous principles entices sharks to attack their ministry. For example, many churches have remained silent concerning God's will for civil government because they fear having their tax-exempt status revoked. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Others remain quiet because they are apathetic, apostate, or simply clueless as to what the Bible really says on issues making news headlines. This does not mean that such churches are not doing anything, but rather they may focus upon low-keyed, amiable events to the exclusion of weightier matters that require confrontation over right versus wrong. Their silence has been bought at a price while they merely pretend to preach the whole counsel of God's word. The cost is a community that is left to practice that which is seen as right in its own eyes. Before advocating strategies for Christians to rightly influence affairs of state, it would be wise to first understand God's model for government and glean insight from it. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 15, and 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 5 through 28, we learn that Moses gave instructions concerning the ultimate expression of civil government, stating that it was God's design that the Hebrews would eventually accept a king to lead their nation as a judge, lawgiver, leader of the people, and champion of peace. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 20, Moses also gave specific rules for the king to follow, some of which were specific to Israel. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 36, Moses even gave a prophecy regarding the fate of one future king. You know, if David had been the first king, it would have marked about a thousand-year history from his kingdom to Christ's ministry. Incidentally, Christ's earthly kingdom will also last 1,000 years. Regrettably, the Hebrews rejected God's timetable and pushed for a king one generation too soon, anointing Saul as king. Nevertheless, it was a monarchy, not a democracy, republicanism, socialism, or communism that God chose to institute, and it will be monarchies that Christ will establish for all the nations in the future. We should not follow our heart, but rather lead our heart in righteousness. Yet many people today think that freedom is the liberty to do what we want, when we want, the way we want, with minimum external restrictions. However, the philosophy of doing that which is right in our own eyes will lead to destruction. True freedom comes only to the degree that society honors obligations we have to God, because these responsibilities to God are what our rights are predicated upon. For example, we have an obligation to protect ourselves from harm. Thus, we have a right to bear arms. We have an obligation to be industrious and provide a living for ourselves, our family, and an inheritance to our posterity. Therefore, we have a right to own private property. Ultimately, civil government is to defend our freedom by fostering a climate in which we can faithfully discharge our obligations to God. This is why even pagan nations historically viewed their king as being an emissary of their gods. Distorted as their religions often were, they nonetheless had rudimentary understanding that the true source of liberty and justice originated from beyond the limits of their political community. As such, ancient civilizations viewed their king as a representative commissioned by the gods to be a lawgiver, a judge, the leader of the people, and a military champion. These qualities were viewed to be inseparable from each other. You could not be the king and not also be the lawgiver, great judge, or the head of military might. The prophet Isaiah often alluded to well-known pagan customs and stories, only to use them to illustrate great truths about Jehovah. In describing what the position of a godly king entails, Isaiah struck chords familiar to the surrounding pagan nations when he wrote in Isaiah 33:22, quote, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us." Isaiah did not describe three or four separate branches of government, but rather the historic function of a king as understood back then. Multifaceted presentations of one person was not uncommon to Isaiah. He also wrote the fourfold name of Christ. Quote, "The government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." Unfortunately, well-meaning men abandoned the traditional interpretation of Isaiah 33:22 and its leadership of a king to conduct an experiment in which they envisioned that Isaiah outlined three independent branches of government: executive, judicial, and legislative. However, such an understanding imposes upon the text a foreign concept instead of seeing it as it was seen by its original audience, the manifold function of a king. Visionaries of this experimental form of government thought that their wisdom would somehow overcome evil tendencies within the hearts of men. Their good but misguided intentions brought negative repercussions. Most Christians can quote the following passage from Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 through 14, but very few of them believe it enough to apply it to real life. Quote, "Enter ye at the strait gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it." End quote. Popular Christian leaders bemoan left-wing judicial activists, but the problem is much more fundamental. Broad is the way that leads to destruction, and the majority want to go down that path. This principle is echoed throughout the Bible. Therefore, since God ordained civil government, how do Christians think that they can hand the power of civil government into the hands of the masses without destructive repercussions? Do they think that the masses will on average make destructive choices everywhere else, but make righteous choices when it comes to discovering laws or making regulations for behavior? Any church that earnestly contends for the faith by using the law to convict the masses of their wayward condition knows that the majority rule tends towards evil. Like the pig that wallows in the mud but cannot see itself as unclean, so is the majority of humanity. The nature of people has not changed since the time of the Roman Empire. The Christian scholar Alcuin wrote to Emperor Charlemagne around 800 AD and advised, quote, "We would not listen to those who are wont to say the voice of the people is the voice of God, for the voice of the mob is near akin to madness." End quote. Unfortunately, the doctrine of vox populi, vox dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God, is the foundation of many modern civil governments. Through misrepresenting Isaiah, misguided patriotism, and a lack of understanding biblical concepts of laws, Christians have whitewashed majority rule for civil government to make it seem biblical. This warped view is so strong that even Christian homeschool curriculum has fallen prey to revisionist history to paint majority rule in a favorable light. For example, Thomas Jefferson was an anti-Christian scoffer of the Bible, who is burning in hell today. He deplored the Bible, heaping severe criticism at it to the point of literally cutting major sections out of the Bible to create an anorexic version. Jefferson stripped all the references to miracles, the deity of Christ, the virgin birth, Christ fulfilling prophecy, Jesus' victory over temptation, and the teachings of the Apostle Paul. According to Jefferson, Jesus left the man who had been blind since birth unhealed. Malchus was left with his ear cut off, and Lazarus was left rotting in the tomb. The Jefferson Bible also leaves Jesus dead in a tomb. Yet, because Jefferson is so closely aligned with the liberal doctrine of democracy and majority rule for civil government, virtually every Christian homeschool history book and book on civil government paints him as being a God-honoring Christian. Such is the voice of madness. If a nation's people are given to the pursuit of God, they will find life, liberty, and property ownership along the way. For example, Scripture plainly teaches in Psalms 119, verse 45, and 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 17, that it is those who seek God's precepts that will walk in freedom, and that where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. When the Bible was the reading primer, and when American colleges were founded to advance the gospel, basic biblical concepts promoting true liberty flowed much more freely in public life. Whenever freedom was constricted, such as with Negro slavery, it was when men lifted their ideals above that of the Bible. Notwithstanding, America has forgotten that the strength of her liberty and prosperity came through an imperfect understanding of the knowledge of the Lord, not democracy. Sadly, our nation has sunken so far into darkness that it now thinks that it can export democracy or constitutional mob rule to a pagan, anti-Christian part of the world, such as Iraq, and call it a new era for liberty and freedom. Are we Christians so blind as to believe that true freedom can be attained for any people apart from the influence of Christ and biblical values? The task of thwarting evil is far more daunting in democracies and republics than in a kingdom. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 8 and 20, verse 26 reveal that under the biblical mode of civil government, all it takes to turn a nation from wickedness is for one righteous man to ascend to the throne. Under a Republican or Democratic split branch system, however, even if Jesus were to become president, it still would not halt the nation's descent into darkness. This is especially true where an oligarchy of judicial activists rule supreme. For this reason, Americans should thank God that their civil government is inefficient. If any civil government today were 100% efficient in the way it managed its governmental resources, its citizens would wind up having less freedom. This is especially true for America. Why? Because the majority is geared toward the broad path. A more efficient stride would take America further down that path of destruction at a quicker pace. Between choosing a kingdom, democracy, or communism, there are no guarantees that any nation will be righteous. But the odds of stemming the tide of evil in a civil government are always better when we follow God's pattern instead of our vain experiments. Remember, the biblical pattern for government has the authority of law and power flowing downhill, not up. Where replacing one evil man with a righteous man can turn the tide of morality in a nation. Now, none of this means that Christians should not be patriotic or influence politics in the system they find themselves trapped in. But it is a call to be biblical in what is campaigned as being right, and not to idolize modern examples of civil government. Whether a Christian lives in America or in China, his Christian responsibilities do not change, but rather only the opportunities to perform those responsibilities. Whenever Christians interact with political elections, they should use biblical qualifications as their guide and not endorse elections when candidates are anti-biblical. A candidate may present himself as being competent to lead, but competence without godly virtue simply makes one more effective in doing wrong. In contrast, godly virtue is, in itself, an expression of competence. If godly virtue is a requirement for civil leadership, then a lack of sound morals in a man is a sign of incompetence and grounds enough not to endorse him for civil leadership. According to Moses in Exodus chapter 18, verse 21, certain criteria had to be met before selection to public office. The capable candidate must be a God-fearing man, hating covetousness, and showing an aptitude towards prudence and wisdom. These traits are always points to consider when evaluating someone for a position that will influence morality and judgment over others. Of course, such criteria would disqualify atheists, agnostics, and hypocrites from being a judge or lawgiver. They have no solid moral foundation from which to adjudicate. These same qualities are also highlighted in the New Testament canon, and again, they were prescribed for use when evaluating whether or not someone is fit for a leadership position that enacts moral judgments from an official position. For example, though the connection is often overlooked, the simple qualifications listed in Exodus 18:21 are expanded for greater clarity in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 11, where Paul uses the principles to enumerate the qualifications of a church leader. As stated in the chapter on church discipline, these qualities are indicative of any mature believer and, excluding the requirement to be a man, are qualities that all Christians are expected to eventually achieve. More to the point, such earmarks of moral and mental qualities are to be the reputation of any candidate that believers propose for appointment to an office involving moral leadership. It is disappointing, but most Christians do not even give a passing thought regarding the biblical qualifications for office listed by Moses or Paul whenever they vote for political candidates. One result is that Christians end up voting to put anti-Christians into office, and they justify such double-mindedness as being a necessary choice toward an alleged lesser evil. On the contrary, one Antichrist may seem better than another, but Christians should not have their hands in elevating either one. Christians should never campaign for an Antichrist to take the reins of moral leadership. This principle can be found in 1 John chapter 2, verses 18 and 22, chapter 4, verse 3, and 2 John chapter 1, verse 7. However, even when Christians endorse a fellow believer, they usually fail to consider whether the believer fulfills these two qualification lists. As such, Christians are put into public office before they are truly ready. Paul issued a warning in 1 Timothy 3:6 regarding premature placement of zealous Christians in office, stating that the believer should not be a novice because the devil will use their lack of maturity to compromise biblical principles. This might explain why so many Christian politicians may start out meaning well, only to end up endorsing unbiblical legislation, such as treating abortion, a mala in se crime, as something they should regulate as a mala prohibita offense. This may also explain why so many Christian politicians wind up endorsing anti-Christian candidates for the sake of party politics. Novices have yet to learn to go beyond fighting mere flesh and blood to being capable of fighting with the power of uncompromised moral principles that flow from the character of God. As Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12 points out, quote, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places," end quote. When Christians are offered principles from Exodus chapter 18:21 and 1 Timothy 3 verses 1 through 11 to guide them on choosing political candidates, their first complaint is usually, "There's no such thing as a perfect candidate." Such a plea is often used by religious leaders to cover up the fact that they are selecting candidates from a pool of immoral contestants while turning a blind eye and intentionally ignoring any moral contestant who is also running for the office. The vast majority of Christians follow such blind leaders because they do not know which issues are more important than others, or which issues should never be compromised. However, by understanding how God's flow of authority works, what spheres of power were delegated, the nature of those spheres, and whether or not God exercises a level of tolerance to a sphere, will help Christians in discerning which imperfect candidates can rightly be accepted by Christians. When God instituted civil government, he bequeathed it with areas of responsibilities and authority. Taxation, the act of rendering honor to whom honor is due, is perhaps the sphere of authority that is least adored by those who have to pay. Yet, it is a legitimate function of government. Though there may be a recommended limit on the percentage of income taken as taxes, there is a level of tolerance given by God to rulers when they decide how much tax they can collect. For example, though 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 17 and 18 paints a 10% income tax as being heavy-handed, Joseph instituted a 20% income tax law in Genesis 47, verse 26, without being accused of stealing from the poor to give to the rich. This is because God extends a level of tolerance to civil rulers when it comes to things pertaining to property and protocol. Although Christians may proclaim what God's optimal design is for such spheres, they have no legitimate grounds to incite rebellion when rulers push the envelope beyond what God intended in the spheres of property or policymaking. The amount of tolerance extended on areas of property and protocol should not be confused with graded absolutism. On the contrary, thou shalt not steal is just as valid as thou shalt not murder. However, when it comes to property and authority, God is the ultimate property owner. For example, Psalms 50, verse 12, states, If I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine, and the fullness thereof. Likewise, Colossians chapter 1, verse 16 teaches that all things that were created in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, were created by him and for him. As such, when God delegates ownership of anything to us, he can also limit the degree of that ownership and give overriding authority to a civil magistrate. Though civil authority is also limited in power over such things, because they are higher within the flow of God's authority and because the flexibility of their control is dynamic, God is prone to conditionally tolerate their decisions when they push the envelope on matters of property and protocol. In contrast, God is intolerant when it comes to issues violating the spheres of personhood and God's design for the family. As such, Christians are within their rights to severely censor civil leaders who endorse in any way such things as adultery, homosexuality, kidnapping, or murder. This is why prophets and preachers picketed civil leaders for violating the domain of personhood. For example, though King Herod pushed the envelope when it came to issues of property and protocol, he did not face the boisterous fury of John the Baptist protesting outside his house until he violated the personhood of another. For example, he took his brother Philip's wife in adultery. Sadly, nationally known religious leaders have taught Christians to flip-flop the principles regarding infringements upon property and protocol versus personhood. Today's national conservative commentators are intolerant of a political candidate pushing the envelope on property or protocol, yet they display a level of tolerance and give an approving nod when a candidate's political posture attacks the family unit or personhood of the preborn or handicapped. For example, during the 2008 U.S. presidential campaigns, the most conservative of the so-called conservative groups took great exception to a candidate's record regarding taxation, the war in Iraq, the economy, or policies on illegal immigration, and showed virtually no tolerance toward a candidate straying from their party's economic platform. On the other hand, these same groups extended a level of tolerance to candidates when it came to the murder of preborn children or homosexuality, especially when these candidates were perceived as viable contenders against the other party's candidates. Republican pro-abortionist Rudy Giuliani, for example, received glowing approval from such religious leaders as Pat Robertson. Mitt Romney, who created a law providing government money for abortions and forced a Gay Marriage Protection Act upon Massachusetts while he was governor, also received raving endorsements from leading evangelicals, including the president of Bob Jones University, and from National Right to Life's legal counselor James Bopp. Democratic Party candidates were no better. Barack Obama argued in favor of infanticide. As a senator, Obama held a bill in limbo that would have protected babies born alive from being murdered after delivery. His position was even more extreme than pro-abortion-minded Hillary Clinton. Despite this, both Obama and Clinton received widespread support from liberal church members. Libertarian Party candidates are against any level of government using the force of law to restrict abortions. A softer version of the libertarian position has found its niche in Republican politics. For example, Ron Paul believes that states have a right to decide if they will allow abortion, and he was heralded by many in the religious right as being the champion for conservatives. On the contrary, rights arise from our obligation to God. There is no obligation to God that would give any level of government authority to legalize mala in se behavior. Despite godly obligations, prior to Roe v. Wade, 19 states permitted abortion, some up to 6 months. This is the kind of pro-abortion climate that states' rights politicians endorse. In fact, Ron Paul sponsored a bill prohibiting the federal government from making any ruling restricting or banning a state from choosing to permit abortions, though the 14th Amendment clearly prohibits any state from allowing the execution of a person without the due process of a capital conviction. Like libertarians, Ron Paul ignores constitutional protection against unjustly depriving life from innocent persons because he believes the federal government has no jurisdiction when it comes to the unborn. Fred Thompson also garnered support from those on the religious right, though he said that states should decide whether or not to criminalize young women for early-term abortions. Though John McCain agreed that there should be exceptions to allow for abortion, and though he and Sarah Palin later stated that states should decide the matter, many on the conservative side tolerated their position with open arms. Instead of defending the innocent in all states, their warped moral compass would have Mordecai and Queen Esther campaigning King Ahasuerus for a federal decree so that each state province could decide for themselves whether innocent Jews can be killed without legal repercussions. You can compare their mindset with Esther chapter 8, verse 5. Can candidates who allow states to approve of abortion, euthanasia, or genocide, or who restrict government from prohibiting abortion, euthanasia, or genocide, meet the qualifications for office listed by Moses or Paul? The answer is no. Such people do not display prudent wisdom and judgment. On the contrary, though Alan Keyes pushed the envelope on property and protocol issues beyond the ideals presented in this book, he was perhaps the only candidate that truly believes in the personhood of the unborn and handicapped. How did the majority of conservatives react to him? In total ambivalence. The Republican Party went out of its way to keep Keyes out of the news, even to the point of omitting his name from the Iowa ticket. Reports that he had withdrawn from the race were circulated as fact in the Florida primary. Christians were largely unaware that Keyes was even running in the Republican primary. However, for those who knew that Keyes was in the race, many still wasted their vote for men that do not believe that every unborn child has a right to life. Ambassador Keyes may have been the only 2008 presidential candidate that truly believes in the personhood of the unborn. But since Christian and public media are prone to neglect reporting on such candidates, there may have been other true pro-life candidates that went unnoticed. The fact that news media across the board omitted the nationally recognized name of Alan Keyes from their lists of candidates, though at times including the names of obscure or little-known pro-abortion candidates, should demonstrate that Christians cannot depend on national or Christian media to inform them of virtuous candidates. Such blackouts by the media and religious organizations begs the question, How can a God-honoring candidate become viable when even God's people refuse to admit he is a candidate? If a candidate is found faithful on matters of personhood, he demonstrates knowledge of the difference between right and wrong. As such, he has a foundation upon which Christians can argue or persuade on matters of property and protocol to bring him more in line with biblical ideals. However, when a candidate does not recognize basic rights regarding personhood and life, then all other issues become superfluous. On the contrary, modern political pundits turn such a simple, biblically-based principle upside down. They would have you believe that if a candidate sees eye-to-eye on party platforms regarding property and protocol issues, taxation, economics, war, environment, tariffs, health care, etc., then he can be endorsed in hopes that his position on personhood issues could be swayed through opinion polls or party pressure. In other words, today's political endorsements call for intolerance on matters of property and protocol, but broad-mindedness on matters of personhood and a right to life. Christians should do right and risk the consequences. They should stand for righteousness even in the face of possible political demise. Politicians will always end up doing something contrary to God's will, and Christians should admonish or rebuke them over such issues. Besides John the Baptist, Jeremiah, Samuel, and Daniel, many other biblical leaders also protested unrighteous decisions made by their government leaders. In like fashion, when a candidate for office espouses the shedding of innocent blood, such as abortion, euthanasia, or genocide, this decision carries with it unrecoverable consequences that prevent Christians from endorsing them for any office. Again, the same is true for candidates endorsing adultery and homosexuality. By the way, these all fall under biblical capital punishment criminal statutes. As true ambassadors of Christ, whenever we are faced with an election in which none of the candidates deserve our endorsement, it is high time to protest and picket the candidates, especially the one gaining the greatest support from the public. Far too often, unscrupulous political scammers pretend to have virtue and Christians are beguiled by them. In an effort to put such politicians on notice, American Right to Life Action evaluated the front-running Republican candidate in the Iowa primary, Mitt Romney, and then ran ads exposing him as willing to lie on the issue of abortion to gain Christian votes. Their televised advertisements stung Romney's campaign. Televised ads were then run in the South Carolina primary. Shortly thereafter, Romney, once a leading contender, bowed out of the presidential race, having been exposed as a liar. Christians can influence politics in this manner. Otherwise, there will be something worse than an evil politician being elected. It will be the righteous after they tolerate compromises on "thou shalt not shed innocent blood." Sadly, most Christians now fear man more than they fear God. You can hear it in their voices when they justify themselves for abandoning unbending moral scruples as they point to their fear of the other party's candidate. However, when there is no godly candidate, a blatantly wicked man elected by the majority is the lesser of two evils. Why? It is one thing for the wicked to advocate placing a wicked man into power. It's another thing entirely when the righteous advocate placing some other wicked man into power. This point, of course, is lost on those who believe the ends justifies the means, or that they must do anything possible to stop the opposing party. The Republican Party has long known that they can offer up a wicked presidential candidate if they can find a vice presidential running mate that will fool Christians into believing that such is a godly campaign ticket, especially when compared to the opposing party. For example, in 2008, pro-choice John McCain chose Sarah Palin, a woman who also believed that abortion should not be criminalized. Though Palin would not commit abortion herself, she nevertheless believes that killing an unborn child should be a legal option. Though not a pro-abortion position, she is pro-choice regarding abortion. However, her apathy in not being anti-choice on abortion undermines absolute morality. On several key issues, Palin takes evil stands, but she was successfully sold to many Christians as a true conservative and this perception was anchored by contrasting her against the fear generated by Senator Obama. This tactic was also used in 1996 by Robert Dole, taking Jack Kemp as a running mate against Bill Clinton and Al Gore. Such political posturing by the Republican Party is done in hopes that Christians will fear a man from the opposing party more than they fear God. Christians swallow the baited hook when they turn their back on absolute morality in favor of comparative or situational morality. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 13 through 24, King Saul thought he had to do something, anything, even if it was wrong, because of what he thought the political fallout might be. To Saul, simply standing on a command from God was too much to ask if it meant political suicide. Saul feared men more than he feared God. Too bad we didn't learn from his mistake, that obedience is better than sacrifice, or to put it another way, that the end or goal does not justify the means. Likewise, Judas Iscariot found Jesus' principles beneficial until he realized that abiding by them appeared to only destine him to be ostracized from having a say in the political future of his nation. Too bad we didn't learn from his mistake. A man cannot serve two masters. Instead, in hopes of being good Americans, most Christians have followed the example of the Pharisees recorded in John chapter 11, verse 48, and chapter 18, verse 40. Out of fear of what the opposing political powers might do, the Pharisees ignored the plight of the innocent to vote for a wicked man, Barabbas, for the so-called greater good and to secure their place in national politics. Today's Christianity is likewise marked by voting for a wicked man instead of supporting a godly man who faces being crucified at the polls. Will God hold us accountable for what the wicked do after we have stood firmly upon absolute moral principles? No. God cannot blame anyone for standing upon his moral character. For example, study Mordecai in the book of Esther. The whole book is something of a paradox, since Mordecai helped save his people from a threat that might not have taken root if it had not first been for Mordecai stubbornly fearing God more than man. Esther chapter 3, verses 1 through 6 reveals that it was Mordecai's refusal to bow to political pressure that caused Haman to target the Jews for annihilation. However, in Esther chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, and chapter 4, verse 16, both Mordecai and Esther chose an allegiance to God to protect the innocent above their own self-interest, to fear God more than they feared man, and such led to the salvation of their people. Esther knew that regardless the possible outcome, she had to stand and say, "If I perish, I perish." But modern Christians are more afraid of what man can do to them. If the book of Esther ended differently, by seeing all the Jews slaughtered, would it then have been wrong for Mordecai to have caused the initial political backlash by not bowing to political pressure from Haman? Or wrong for Esther to make a politically charged statement for God in the face of doom? No, since God's sense of right and wrong is independent of the situation or immediate outcome. Regarding politics, Christians would do well to adopt a voter's guide approved by Jesus. "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things, good economy, good property and protocol strategy, good housing market, etc., shall be added unto you." Why is it that Christians will sing this Matthew 6:33 verse as a hymn in church services, but then ignore it during election campaigns? Why do churches forget Esther's political lesson to us all? It's because when it comes to politics, Christians quickly forget the words of Jesus, recorded in Matthew 10:28. Quote, "And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." End quote. If we ignore the testimony of men like Mordecai and destroy the foundation of absolute morality through political compromise, what shall the righteous do to escape blame. Psalm 11:3 raises a similar question. If God can hold us accountable when we do not warn the wicked to depart from his wicked way, as suggested in Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 18 and 19, then are we warning the wicked politician or affirming him in his wickedness when we vote for him to become a ruler over us? When an opportunity to fulfill our Christian responsibility presents itself in the form of a voter's booth, our rebuke to the wicked should not be wasted by voting for the wicked. When it comes to desiring overt wickedness to be placed into power, we are either part of the resistance or we are collaborators. We should not think that we can avoid God's displeasure for doing evil, even if it looks like the best alternative, merely because we meant well. Again, as Christians, we should do right and risk the consequences, exemplifying God's righteousness by faith. God can be glorified even when there are only a few standing for righteousness. Disappointingly, Christians fret themselves over not having enough people to stand with them in a political battle. But in the book of Judges, chapter 7, verses 2 through 8, God twice insisted that Gideon had gathered too many warriors to be of any real help. It was only after Gideon's army shrank from 32,000 to only 300 that God gave his blessing. Even though the masses generally choose the path towards death and destruction, revival can occasionally turn the tide, and revival is the only thing that really can save America. However, revival will not come to America or anywhere else when God's people refuse to humble themselves to his righteousness. You've been listening to chapter 29 of Eden's Tree of Life. You can find a copy of this on supremejustice.net.